You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
A little something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional, unprofessional. So if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedian's Comedian Podcast. Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and it's another Edinburgh Live special from the Gilded Balloon. And this is another blinder, though I do say so myself. We've got someone who has a foot in both of two usually opposing camps. That's the experimental theatrical storytelling thing, as well as the undeniable roof-raising club comedy thing. It can only be Phil Nichol. Thanks a lot for coming, Phil. Yeah, have a seat.
Thank you.
You've having me. You've brought some natural coconut water with you.
I did bring some. This is I keep revitalized. I'm not selling it, but I keep revitalized with Vita Coco. I drink two of these a day, and it's like drinking water. It's good for you.
Is it when you say it's like drinking water? Is it better than water?
It's better than water. It's got all the electrolytes in it. Plus, it's got lots of sodium. The coconut skin works as a natural filter for rainwater, and the coconut itself, the seed feeds off the water inside it, which is what the coconut water is, and it's slightly better for you than water itself.
Incredible. We're looking at potential sponsorship here. That's as good as any other. Listen, you and I, well, I saw your show a couple of afternoons ago, and it's an afternoon show, isn't it?
It is. It's a 2:30 in the afternoon show.
And that's presumably a very deliberate choice on your part.
It was actually accidental. I was supposed to be doing a show, a play called The Shawshank Redemption for Tommy Shepard and the Assembly Rooms. And then he called me a week later and said, look, I have a 2:30 room. If you're up doing the festival anyway, you could do a 2:30 show as well. And I was like, well, it was March. Someone had dropped out. And I was like, I don't think I want to spend the summer writing, trying to rush to write a whole hour of comedy. So like an idiot, I said, well, I'll do a theater show instead. And I just named a title. I had a basic idea of what I was going to talk about. And it's ended up being a theater, thinking that theater is easier to write than comedy. It's not. So I'm doing that. But then I ended up being cast in a play that went to the Manchester International Festival in July, which meant that I couldn't make the rehearsal for The Shawshank Redemption. But I do have August off, so I'm only doing the one show, the 2:30 show that I didn't want to do in the first place. It's a mess.
Yeah. But the show itself, so that's interesting. So the show that I saw, you refer to as a theatre show rather than a stand-up show.
Well, yes, it's called The Weary Land. I think it's a comic monologue, because people forget that in theatre you can have comical things as well, but because we have this comedy theater definition, but people think by definition that you go into theater, things have to be serious and really earnest, and comedy things are all light and surreal and whimsical, and it's not necessarily the case. And I think one of the issues they're having with the festival is to know where to put your show. You could put your show in there used to be no cabaret section. They used to put their show in the comedy section. People go along, go, well, it's not very funny, you know, a guy dancing around dressed as a pineapple. Well, it's not supposed to be funny, is it?
And you're speaking as someone who you, this is, you were saying this is your 15th Edinburgh Festival.
It's my 21st Edinburgh Festival.
Okay.
It's my 15th solo show.
Okay. Yeah. I was looking at your website earlier on, and the list is quite interesting. You've put little paragraph explaining what's happened with all of those 15 shows and what they were and where they come from.
Yeah.
And what strikes me is that you have enormous breadth and range as a comedian. You've come up here with shows that are theatre pieces, with shows that are straight stand-up or simple stand-up, as you call it. You have songs. You do poetry.
Yeah.
You seem to have just an enormous range.
Yeah.
And I'm just interested in...
Why
have
you been heard of? Why no one knows who I am? I don't know.
Do you feel that no one knows who you are?
I don't know. Maybe it's because I'm really average at all of it. Just sort of average at a whole bunch of things.
I don't know if there's enough people in this room right now, and this will be different to the listenership of the podcast, who are just aware of how successful you are at making rooms full of people cry laughing.
Oh, well, thank you.
So so your kind of humility there of going, maybe I'm average, I felt there was slightly people going, is he average? But he's very much not. I mean, you're...
Well, yeah, I mean, that's all. It's, you know, it's subjective, isn't it? Someone might find me really funny and someone else might think that you're the most horrible person in the world. It's just, that's the beauty of comedy.
Sure.
If that's beautiful. What I'm saying is that you don't know. If it's something like, there are very few things where right across the board, everyone loves it. It's very rare, like The Simpsons or things, or Family Guy. It's very rare. You know, something that's almost, you probably would find people out there that don't like those things, but they wouldn't even mention it in public because they'd feel like most people would turn and go, what are you talking about? It's my favorite show. And everyone goes, yeah, don't you remember the episode? And I'm not one of those. I'm one of the ones where people go, who?
Does that affect you? Do you have an emotional reaction to that? Do you want to be more known than you are?
Well, no, to be honest, I think I turned a corner on that. I used to be part of a comedy act called Corky and the Juice Pigs. It was a trio, and we were quite successful. We got from Toronto, and we spent a lot of time in Hollywood near the end of our career, and we were on development deals with the Disney company. We auditioned for Steven Spielberg for a Spielberg film, so, you know, it's pretty successful. I think nothing came of it, and we didn't get the part in the film, and we were on a program called Mad TV for a whole season doing musical comedy stuff. So, you know, that's quite successful. And then when I started doing stand-up, when that all fell apart, I had to go back to doing open spots and stand-up. I realized it's my second comedy career. There's a lot of things that go, trappings that go with that, that were turning me into quite a horrible person. And a bit of an idiot, really. Slick back hair, aviator sunglasses, you know, smoking cigars, just being a turd, basically. And I believing the hype. And so this time around, I've kind of realized I have a really good life. I have a great life. I get to perform all over the world. I get to write and do these shows in Edinburgh, and I don't have to worry about getting irritated and bothered by someone come up to me in a restaurant. I was standing with a famous comic, a well-known comic, on the streets just yesterday, and the number of people that wanted their photo taken, like, we couldn't have a conversation. He'd finally had to put his sunglasses and a hat on and move. Just to get away from everyone. I that would probably really crush me. I think that would be really, it wouldn't be worth the money to be known that way.
But when you started out doing open spots as a comedian, were you chasing the idea of the success that you'd had with the Juice Pigs?
I wanted to prove to myself that I could, that it wasn't just, the group that broke up through the strain of finance and egos, and I wanted to prove to myself that I wasn't just imagining that I was a strong part of the stronger than the sum of its parts. And I wanted to prove myself that I was actually not just some kind of ligger who'd accidentally got, you know, joined in with some guys who were really good. I had to prove to myself that I actually was part of a thing that was really good. So I did. I've done that. I feel quite comfortable with
that. It's interesting. I got the sense from seeing your show last Sunday that it's interesting. You do seem comfortable. You seem like you're in control now of your work and your future in a way that maybe when I've seen you on stage in clubs and your persona is incredibly hyperactive and manic. I remember we did a gig together years ago on the boat show at the Tattersall Castle in London, and you were doing your kind of room smashing set with a t-shirt over your head and the guitar and the song at the end, and I remember you saying something, I don't want to misquote you, but I think you said something like, this is my club set. Yeah. When I go to Edinburgh, I do interesting stuff. This is me cranking out the gear that gets the encores and the big rounds of applause.
Yeah. That's become more of a, I mean, it's an ongoing argument I have with my, uh, with agents and PRs and friends. You can do comedy in clubs where there'd be like a room like this would be like 100 to 200 people in it who don't come there because there's anyone special on, just because it's a comedy club. And the British comedy scene is by far, in a way, the best comedy scene. It's unfortunately slowly being strangled to death, but that's a whole other story. Mm-hmm. Because you could just show up and you know you're going to get at least one, possibly two, maybe four great comics for your money and have a good night. And British audiences already show up with a sense of humor and they're already enjoying themselves generally. So they show up with, it doesn't matter whether how good the comedians are. So even new act nights can do quite well for numbers. And I realized quite quickly that I could actually just do the same club set wherever I went. And it's not actually doesn't turn me into that's not what turns you into a successful comedian to the next level in this country anymore. You have to have a television profile, and you have to, they need you on Mock the Week. You need to have this sort of other thing going on, and that's what makes you into a touring touring comic, not a club comic. So I kind of have this idea of going, no, I'm not that concerned about my material turnover for doing club comedy, because what I want the audience that comes there to see is my best material, because that's really what they deserve. They don't deserve to see a guy experimenting, where when I come to Edinburgh, it's a different agreement. You've come to watch shows and see some, you're here because you love the arts and you want to see some, you'd rather see someone experiment and pull it off and do really well. That's when you go, wow, that was amazing. I saw Slapdash Galaxy and this guy's experimented with shadow puppets and it's one of the most amazing things I've ever seen. Or you know, I mean, in comedy terms, Daniel Kitson. But if you want to go and see like, just someone that does really good, then you go and see the big name acts that are on here, spend 20 quid, and you're going to go and sit and watch them do an hour of the show they did on tour for 9 months, and it's going to be word perfect and hilarious, but it's not going to be edifying to your artistic soul.
Do you think that you're quite, I mean, that's quite a manifesto, or it's a clear and comfortable opinion for you?
I'm a bit up myself.
Yeah, that's cool.
You told me beforehand, be honest, but I don't,
yeah.
I could be wrong about it all, but I just have a maybe it's a retrospective excuse for not being higher profile, but I'm actually, as you get older, I think you'd be more comfortable. I think you become more comfortable with the way things work out for yourself, and you do. I don't think it's an excuse. I think it's you just realize this is the rationale for where I am and what I'm doing.
Do you think that you're quite I've not heard any other comedians who occupy a similar profile to you, whereby you've won the big award here, and it was interesting. You said you were the George Lazenby of comedy because you won the main comedy award the one year it was called a particular name.
Yeah, well, it was called the Perrier Award for years, so you know, and anyone that's won the Perrier has now, you know, Frank Skinner. I mean, I don't even Lee Evans. They're all household names in Britain, and then I won it one year, and it was the year that Perrier stopped stopped their thing. I won it when it was the if.comedy,
which was a terrible name, wasn't it? The if.com Eddie Award.
It was called the Iffy. Thanks, yeah. Everybody. And it was also Halifax Bank, which the next year went under due to the financial crisis. So it made me the George Lazenby of comedy award winners, because if I put if.comedy on my poster, people go, what's that? But I don't mind that. It almost suits me. It almost is like a theme in my life that I never quite get the thing. I never quite touch the brass ring. And I don't know if that's necessarily a bad thing. It's allowed me to take a longer time. I'm not under, you know, it must be really hard to be someone like Russell Kane, okay? And I'm not saying him for any, I just was the first person.
Just because a big comic, yeah. Someone who's going off at the moment.
But he now has to pull off that level of show all the time. And then that, in essence, one way of doing that is to repeat yourself. And so then he starts to repeat himself. But of course, we're, as human beings, we all get bored. And after a while, people start to go, oh, God, he's doing the same thing. Or you get to know what he's doing, so you lose an audience. And then he has to go through a period of trying to refine himself, whereas I'm constantly just doing the things that I want to say, the things I want to say and do the things I want to do. And I'm able to experiment because I don't have to fear losing an audience because I don't really have one.
So. That's very. I appreciate
each show I've done up here finds an audience, and some of them may be more successful than others. There's enough people that know me that I'm always going to have some people there. So, and I work at this through the Stand and Tommy Shepherd at the Stand because of the financial package that he puts together for shows up here. Mm. I never have to fear of losing money. I'm always going to go away from Edinburgh having a fairly healthy. Not only a financial life, but also a creative life. So it's kind of I'm in a good place, and that's because of this, you know, winning awards and stuff like that. It's just given me that little bit of headroom. that I think younger comics would love to have. So I am lucky.
There seems in the way that you're talking about that now, and I know you, we've gigged together, I don't know you well, there seems in your voice an element of sadness. Do you feel sad?
Sadness?
Yeah, do you feel sad? You seem very calm.
No, I think if I sound sad, well, I don't know. I'm sad that not for me personally, but I'm sad that it seems like there's been a movement in comedy, and I can't really quite get if I've been here 15 years and been doing comedy at Edinburgh since 1990, there has been a shift away from rewarding comedians who are doing exclusive work or exciting, inventive work. And it seems like the odd, for whatever reason, it's kind of like an X Factor mentality where everyone in the audience suddenly thinks they're judges of judging. You're not just going along to enjoy yourself. You're actually sitting in judgment. Oh, well, this guy's not going to be good. Well, he'll never get on Mock the Week. We're all looking for the next big thing, that we've lost sight of what comedy actually is supposed to do, which is supposed to experiment. So it's becoming a little bit that it's not as rewarding to be an adventurous comic. And it's becoming less and less a popular notion, and there's more and more people on the rise. And I think I'm not saying anything that's groundbreaking. There's more and more people who are getting into comedy simply to get themselves a television career. That's what they think the goal is. And that, for me, that's not what the goal is anymore. It was when I was young, and I'm not denying that. I was madly in love with myself when I was in Hollywood, and I was a complete jerk off. But now I think, I stopped thinking of, it used to be kind of, comedians won't let each other get too up themselves. You couldn't say comedy was an art, or else you'd take the mickey out of you. But I think with the Daniel Kitsons and the David O'Doherty's, people are starting to go, well, it is an art form, and it does have, you can take it places, and it can be original, and it can be really satisfying and edifying for an audience to see something of extreme originality. It's just, I don't think there's as much of an appetite for it, because it's a trendy thing, and that's not what the people sitting here at your podcast, your adventurers coming into this, and I laud you for it, but it should be full. That's just the fact to me.
It is full.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's great. I love a 20-seat theater. I have to say. But I don't think I'm saying anything groundbreaking, but just as an older comic. And I don't think it's sad. I don't think it's sad for me, but it would be nice to see it shift back that other way. Mm. I think the Free Fringe is a fantastic up here at the Edinburgh Fringe.
Yeah, I mean,
but if only that notion could be taken back to, little towns, Rugby, Peterborough. In fact, that's not fair, because I found what's happening is all the lovely little gigs that are happening, all the really fun little gigs and the really supportive little gigs are actually happening outside the city's capitals, outside the big cities and the city's capital. And I end up having a great time going to some little tiny gig in the middle of nowhere, whereas if you go to the big comedy clubs, it's just become like a homogenized white noise of comedy. And because there's so much of it, because you see television, there's a lot of people are going to watch comedy that wouldn't have gone normally, because they want to go and see the type of thing they saw on television, not realizing the amount of editing and the amount of stuff that goes into putting a television comic on should have no reflection and no basis of what happens in a club. So my favorite comedians are like Phil Kay. He does a completely different, tries to do something completely different every night. And at one time he was the king of comedy here in Edinburgh, and you wouldn't see a better show. And now I think it's if you talk to him on your show, he'll probably express a similar, I don't think it's sadness, I just think it's it's just the way it is. So I've just given into it.
Do you, what I think something that you are saying that's unusual is, in terms of your club work and the fact that your club set is this devastating, and it really is, for anyone that hasn't seen it. I remember seeing it in Mirabelle, say, at the Altitude Festival, where just people would be standing on the chairs going mental at the end of your show.
Yeah.
Your decision to still be... I think what I'm trying to say is that there seems normally to be two sorts of comedians. There's the comedians that play the clubs and have the same gig every year. They have the same set and never change it. And then there's the comedians who are constantly turning over material and coming to Edinburgh. And you're quite unusual, I think, in that you seem to be doing both things. Do you think you're doing the experimental, interesting stuff, and you've got the productive? It's almost like you're one of my friends from the street performance world who've got the moneymaker show that they go out and do, and then they've got that allows them the time to do the interesting thing. And I just wonder whether any part of you feels that if you were turning over more stuff in the clubs, it would have any sort of, I mean, would that help you get on TV? Would you be interested in getting on TV?
I'm told that that's what, I mean, it's getting personal, I guess, to the point of this thing.
If it's okay with you.
I'm told by, well, if you know a little bit about the industry, that you've agents and managers are working behind the scenes to try and get you onto these things. And a lot of the people we see on these programs are all belong to the like two or three main agents who are really powerful, and they have the major acts, and they can use those, that power in with and the connections, because like in any business, it's who you know. They have connections and power with the people that make those decisions to get those acts on. And I am with someone who's been a friend of mine for a long time, and although she has a couple of like really really hot clients, she's not a hugely powerful agent in the same sense that those big agencies are. And so the one thing she continues to tell me, that the one way she would be able to pitch me again for these television shows would be if I was to be seen as someone who was turning over a hot club set. And now, I don't agree that that's necessarily true, and I don't think that the casting agents and the people that book these shows go and see comedy anymore. I think they might come here for the television thing and get taken to a show by one of those agents because they feel they need to be successful with that agent in order to work in the business, because it's a mutual thing. And I'm not saying that's good or bad, that's just business.
I think there's a great deal of frustration in the comedy world at the moment. I've certainly noticed in the 9 years since I've been doing stand-up that I feel like we've divided into the A stream and the B stream.
Yeah.
And the A stream are the comics who have the same appearances on the same TV shows, the same, five, six different TV shows on all their posters.
Yeah.
And then there's us. There's the other people.
Yeah, and you know, and it doesn't actually even add up. And not to knock any of those people, because in that A stream, to use that term, there's loads of fantastic comics.
Absolutely.
And, people you see on QI and like Sean Locke and all those guys, they're amazing. They're really good comics and have worked a long time really hard to get to that point and been through this process. And there's a large group of us who are of a similar age and similar generation who are still doing the stuff that I'm doing and doing the stuff that we're doing. But if you were to replace any one of them, they are kind of replaceable because... on a given night, Stuart Goldsmith is as funny as any of those people you will see on television. I can guarantee you that.
My poster, by the way.
Yeah. No, it's.
I understand the point you're making.
I think anyone that's been able to make anyone that's been doing comedy in this country any longer than 8 years to 10 years has to be a decent level of comic. It's really hard. You get weeded out quite quickly. With the clubs, because you either can do it or you can't, and it's not the audiences either go with you or they don't, and you're either consistent. You might have some personal problems that make it more difficult for you. You may suffer some personal issues that stop you from gaining that access, or you might be just a very uncomfortable person that makes it difficult for you to fit in, or you might be someone where you have an aversion to it, so therefore it becomes you write your own history, you write your own future then and not get it. So that's why there's a B stream.
So this is Phil. I'm so pleased that he felt able to be so so candid and speak so frankly. He was very, very open. And bless him, he did make, as you'll hear, make frequent reference to his situation, to how uncomfortable he felt talking about the stuff, and obviously the worries that people have that other people might judge them based on something as revealing as an interview like this. So I'm really pleased. I'm really glad that he sort of stuck to it. I think we've got some tremendous stuff here. While I remember, do download the, or stream rather, I'm sorry, I've said download before. I think I've only made it available for streaming. You can download the proper version with the blurb later on. But there is the Tony Law interview where Tony Law is in a state of advanced refreshment. You can stream that if you join the Facebook group for the Comedians Comedian podcast, or you go to comedianscomedian.com and have a look on the website, find the link to my mailing list. When you join the mailing list, you'll be sent a link for that. So that one is still available, but I might take it off soonish. Haven't decided yet. Thank you very much for all your emails. I've just got one recently from Bonnie Davis saying she loves the show. And then she said, and she put at the end, thank you so much in capitals, which I liked especially because that's often how Patton Oswalt signs off. It just immediately snaps out of a bit and goes, thank you all so much. And that's the cue, bang, it's over. And funnily enough, on the subject of Patton, another email from Kristen Miller saying, please interview Patton Oswalt. That was all she put in the subject line, short and to the point, very easy for me to get back to. And believe you me, he is in one of my top five favourite interviewees ever. I'm a huge fan of Patton. If you don't know Patton Oswalt, I started with his album Werewolves and Lollipops, and it just gets better and better from there, so give him a listen. Thanks also to, I've no idea of the pronunciation, I'm going to go with Kasia Fudakowski in Berlin for her lovely email. And thanks to Ian Page and Paul Hayes for their comments and support as well. I don't read a lot of these out because mostly what people are saying is thanks, the show's great. And I don't just want to repeat people's praise for me. That's what Twitter's for, surely. But do ask me questions and I'll try and engage with those a bit more. By all means, contribute to the folder of people begging me to get Daniel Kitson on the show. As soon as I've got 1,000 of those emails, I'm going to take them all to Daniel so that he can put them in the bin personally. I should remember to point out as well, Nish Kumar. Now, if you like comedy that's about stuff, you're all intelligent people, I'm sure, most of you are, I'm sure. Nish Kumar is a friend of the show. You'll remember him from his brief cameo on the Josh Widdicombe episode. I'm going to try and get him on soon. But either way, I just want to briefly advertise his Soho run. I think he's doing 2 weeks at the Soho Theatre. Do go and see Nish Kumar. Obviously, he's a friend of mine. I'm going to sort of declare that interest straight away. But he's also a brilliant comedian. His last show at Edinburgh was spectacular and is genuinely about an interesting thing. I don't want to give anything away about it, but it's not just a bloke telling loads of jokes, although it has that element. He's a very gifted comedian. But it's also a very interesting and fascinating show. So do go and see Nish Kumar in his show, Nish Kumar is a Comedian. Now, I've had to cancel the ComCom live appearance at the Sheffield Comedy Festival. I'm really sorry about that. The good news is that the Leicester one is still going ahead, and he's penciled in. I'm going to announce him anyway because he's a good egg. Jared Christmas is going to come on the show. Brilliant improviser, fantastic comic and compere and actor. Jared Christmas is going to be on Leicester Festival ComCom live special on the 16th of February 2014. That's a Sunday and it's going to be at 5 o'clock. So listen out for more details about that. There might be some more London ones coming up as well. I'm sort of trying to work out what they are. I'll tell you what I'm doing when I know, really. This might make you happy as well. Before we get back in, two little things. First, the first question that get asked at the end of this show, the questions were a little bit ragtag. I've previously complimented my listenership on their intelligent questions, but these ones, although intelligent, someone was basically trying to bash Lee Mack's sitcom Not Going Out under the guise of asking Phil Nichol a question. It was a bit weird. And normally I just sort of nibble that out in the edit, but I think it actually led somewhere interesting. So we've stuck with that. It's my normal system of blipping it is, you'll see when you get there. But apologies to Lee Mack if you're listening, Lee. I think me and Phil defended you satisfactorily. Do come on the show sometime. And finally, I think this might make everyone happy. It might not. I managed recently to sort of mentally square a thing with myself that's been bothering me for ages about something I'll ask people on the show over the whole of the Edinburgh specials. Do you consider yourself an entertainer or an artist? And I'd often wondered how I would answer that question myself, and I've worked it out. I'm a bad artist. Brilliant. I'm so pleased with that. I'm sure that's after Simon Munnery, I seem to remember, has got a really good joke about comedy so close to art, and that if it was close to the line of art, then it would be far away from the centre of comedy. But that's not quite what I mean. I just mean that I suppose since I went to university, I've been trying to struggle with the idea of entertaining people. Is it worthwhile? Am I just an entertainer? Is that slagging off entertainers, to use the word just? All of that kind of stuff. It just came to me as if in a dream. And I thought, no, do you know what I am? I'm a bad artist. I aspire to be an artist, which I think is good, but I'm not making any claims to being a great one. But I'd rather be a good entertainer and a bad artist than just a good entertainer. So that's where I am with that at the moment. Join the Facebook group or tweet me at ComComPod or email me info@comedianscomedian.com. Tell me your thoughts on being an artist or an entertainer. That's all of that. That's quite chatty. Can you tell I've been on my own all day? So now let's get back to it with the second half of this interview with the brilliant Phil Nichol. Let's talk about the writing of the show. One of your shows.
By the way, are you guys interested in any of this, or Where's the stag do?
I got a show for you.
Listen, I'm sure these people are listening and interested in focusing. It's very unusual for a lot of comedians to spend this time talking to an audience not getting laughs. And I think it can make you kind of.
Thinking of a stag. Did a stag do once where the whole stag do, and it was in Scotland. It was here during the festival. There's a stag do. So I'm doing like some kind of artsy fartsy theater show somewhere, and I'm going to do a late night gig, a club set, and which is a completely different kettle of fish. And there was a stag do, and the dad was leaning against the wall facing the audience, right? He fell asleep. So I said to the stag do, I climbed up, said, get your cameras ready. And I pulled my trousers down, got my testicles out of my trousers, and leaned over and just started tapping him on the top on his forehead with my testicles till he woke up, while his son and all of his mates took photos of it. So if you want me to do that, I will.
Well, look, even if they're not laughing sometimes, they're definitely not going to be falling asleep now, so that's good.
Exactly. No,
but I think the way into talking about the writing is this honesty. I really appreciate you being so honest about your feelings about it.
I'll be a little bit scared to talk about it because, A, I'm never sure of my own opinion. It fluctuates with time. And I also, I feel uncomfortable speaking from someone who, speaking as someone who isn't a household name or a successful comic in the sense that you guys would understand, having an opinion on it. But I have done it. I have been doing this since 1987. I've got 25 years of experience, and I've never had a day job. I've only ever done comedy, mm-hmm. So I probably should have an opinion on it. But I'm a little bit tense expressing it, because the other thing is, I know people listen to your podcast and they might go, oh god, all you gotta do is say one thing or mention one thing wrong, I might already be in trouble. But, you know, but if I wanted to be ruthless and be really honest, I might get in real trouble.
Sure. Well, there's certainly, I think some people do feel kind of bound by that because the circuit's so small.
Yeah.
But I think equally, the just specifically referring to this interview, I think the most positive reactions I get from my guests get is when they're honest, and when, you know, Terry Alderton was talking about the decision to go on antidepressants, and you know, it's that stuff that, you know. So okay. I appreciate it.
Okay.
You were saying, in fact, do you want to talk about, you mentioned that review earlier on, or should we talk about some happier? Let's talk about some happier stuff first, because there's a lot of good stuff.
No
to get
point
into.
Talking about reviewers. I mean, reviewers in Edinburgh, it's just ridiculous, right? We don't have to get into it. It's the, you know, if The people that are doing the work and creating the shows spend a lot of time and heartfelt effort doing it. As a performer, I think there should be more performers, there should be more singers, more dancers, more jokers. It doesn't matter what level you're at. I think you should appreciate that someone's in front of you trying to do something. And I've seen some dire stuff as well, and it is funny, but I think to sit there and actually try and write it off and put your little opinion down on a piece of paper is an act of cowardice. So let's move on from reviewers.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, let's talk about the bravery then that I think you display in putting your life down on paper and putting your life out there on the stage, because you are unbelievably candid in your shows. You tell, I mean, I was watching, I haven't seen, you know, I've seen some of your shows, but obviously you've produced an enormous amount of material. I was watching something on YouTube earlier on, and it was the story of you snogging your now ex-girlfriend's dad.
Yes.
And that's...
No. He snogged me.
Oh, sure. No, he did. That's absolutely right.
There's a big difference.
But there's, you know, there's a lot. Like, that's a... And I'm assuming this is true, because I think all of your work's true.
Yeah, it's all true.
So, and there's kind of references to drug use in that sort of stuff. There's an awful lot of personal stuff that comes out there.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to ask you about the what drives you to be constantly exposing yourself in that manner.
I just think it's funnier. I don't know. I mean, I love the surrealists. I have always think of myself. I look at like people that do one liners, and I just admire them. I wish I could. In fact, that's part of the Bobby Spade is this character that I developed in because I wanted to try and write that. And I spent a whole summer writing one liners. I think it ended up having like 52 one liners in that show and some poetry and stuff because I really admire them. And I really admire surrealists. I think Tony Law is fantastic and taking it to another level. Paul Foote, you know, I wish I could do something like that. But for me, what I really like watching is when someone really gives of themselves, and you feel like you walk away knowing something about the performer. And so I really like to. There's an Irish comedian called Owen O'Neill who has transcripted the Shawshank Redemption into a play. And he used to do these really heartfelt shows, these really storytelling shows, which were really moving, funny and moving and real, about his alcoholism. It's one he called Off My Face, which is you know, starts with him on the grave of his mother while an RUC helicopter, you know, picks him up, and he thinks they're going to take him away and kill him, so he jumps out of it, you know, and really honest stories that make the audience go, and I just thought I'd try and do that. I thought I would. Mm. It's kind of, I was writing monologues and writing characters, and I thought I'm going to try telling a story. Tried telling stories, and this was like back in the late 90s, and then that has become de rigueur in Edinburgh comedy. Is, you know, who's the most popular? Probably Rod Gilbert. You know, that's a couple of his stories of really intricately wound stories and highly entertaining and funny. But what won him the awards is because they had a beginning, a middle, and an end, and left you thinking, oh, I know something about the guy. Mm. So now when you see him, you think you already feel like you know, you own something of him. And I think that's where I'd like to be trying to do.
Sure. When you're writing, are you sitting down and writing when you come up with a show? I remember hearing a story that you wrote your award-winning Edinburgh show on the train on the way to Edinburgh.
Yeah, that's a rumor. I wrote a show in 1997, and I was having a really bad time. I had just arrived over in Britain after the fault. Well, that my wife and I split up. In a really bad situation, which is in the show, so I won't tell you about it. And then about a month and a half later, Cork the Juice Pigs fell apart. So I lost my seven closest friends, like my support group, in the space of a month and a half. And I came to Britain to try and get away from it all. And my life was literally falling apart under me. I was suicidal, and I can't even go to where how bad it was. And I didn't. I had to come and do this Edinburgh show, and I just hadn't. I just hadn't done anything about it. Mm. I just spent the whole summer really wasted and getting drunk and having a bit of a nervous breakdown, and got on the train and thought, oh God, okay, I've got to do this in a couple of days. So I wrote down a whole bunch of ideas and a story and kind of flashed something together. And this is back in the day where you could actually come up to Edinburgh with an idea, a general idea of what you're going to do. And by the time you leave, you had a great show. But you can't do that anymore because people, they're spending like 10 quid on a ticket, and there's all that you're going up against people that have been touring their show all year, so they come in with this really deadly show. Mm. And the critics have got sharpened pencils that if it's not like amazing day one, you know, it's like this big horrible thing. It used to be you could just show up and there was only the Scotsman in the list reviewing anyway, so even if they may not even get around to reviewing every show, so you didn't even, that's not, you work on word of mouth and flyering and papering and meeting people and talking to people and that's how you got your show together. So I was lucky in that year. I got a really nice show together out of this horrible situation where I talked openly about the emotional breakdown I had.
So when you're writing, when you're sat writing in, you know, on a train on the way here or somewhere else, do you do most of your writing off stage or on stage?
I do. It depends which type of show it is. Last year I did a show called Rants, which was more of a stand-up comedy type show, and it was just like me ranting. I decided to try and do a take on almost a piss take of ranting comedy, where I got really upset about like traffic lights on roundabouts. You know, traffic lights on roundabouts. You know, but I wrote it in sections, and I worked with Kerry Marks and Steve Carlin, some different people, bouncing ideas and trying to get a through line on how to make it work, and I just didn't end up getting the show together very well. So that was very much written, very much scripted piece. Bobby Spade is the character thing I did, which was poetry. I wrote Welcome to Crazy Town was a 1 hour long poem comedy song. So obviously the songs were all written and the poems were written, but then I kind of worked them out on stage how I joined the whole thing and it became. But this show is a story that I've just kind of just started doing on stage, but I only did three previews of it, so I'm only just still finding the story and finding the beats of the things that I will keep, the things that will remain and be the same every day.
And how do you find those beats in the writing process? Is that are you working sort of instinctively from where the audience is laughing? Could you just talk a bit about the dynamic of doing that?
Well, it's really you get really sensitive to an audience when you do it, because this is why it's difficult to do this kind of conversation in front of you. I think you don't normally do it in front of an audience, do you?
We've done about 20 or so, and the rest are in someone's house.
Yeah, yeah. Right. So it's really difficult because I want to please you guys. I really, the idea that you're not in this isn't entertaining you in any way is really affecting me. So when I'm trying to, I want this to be entertaining. So it stops me from being quite as candid as you want. But at the same time, when I'm doing my storytelling shows, I will will start telling a story, and I will look for the important moments in the story, and I will see how they affect you. And then if it works, I will keep it. And today I found one where I talk about going to a counselor, relate counselor with my wife. Mm-hmm. And the counselor was this like really oddly affected guy. He had matching red shoes, matching red socks, matching red trousers, matching red belt, matching red shirt, matching red glasses. And he was really effeminate and wanted to. And he saw her, and I waited outside. Then he saw me, and she waited outside. And then when he came in, he said, I see relationships like plants. Plants are like, you know, like what some relationships are like a cactus that sits out in the middle of a wasteland. And, you know, it's full of water. The cell feeds itself, but it's kind of prickly, and no one really wants to disturb it. Other plants are like ivy that climb up the wall of a building. And it's so beautiful. As the plant gets bigger and longer, it covers the structure, but it eats into the walls and the windowsill, and it causes structural problems. Your plant is dead. Your plant is dead. I say, take it out of the plot and save what you can. And then I drive home with my wife in our car. We've just had this horrible breakup based on some horrible things. And we start laughing for the first time, giggling, our plant is dead. Our plant is dead. Our plant is dead. And then today I discovered if I kept repeating, our plant is dead. Our plant is dead. It's dead. The plant is dead. And I discovered that today just by repeating it. And I was feeding from the audience, because they were finding, as you guys did, it's kind of amusing to be told that by a counselor at Relate. You paid him like $400 to be told your plant is dead. But actually, it gets me into the next part of the story, because our plant was dead. And that beat will now stay in the show now.
Gotcha.
Because the next thing I say is, our plant was dead. And we, the stuff that we did, we broke windows, we broke mirrors, we screamed at each other. Our plant was very dead. So it kind of, that only came out of doing it in front of an audience.
Sure.
Because originally the story was just, that plant is dead, get a laugh, move on.
Okay. So when
does that make sense? That,
so when you get something that gets a laugh, you're able to sort of unpack it. You like that laugh's almost like a peg you can put in and go, right, well, that's there. Now yeah. I can take more risks around it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I worked with a guy called Phil Whelans, who's an improviser and character actor, and he's in Bill Bailey's Beer Gut 100, and he's been in comedy a long time. He's a dear friend, and he directs my shows, and we developed a formula when we started doing these storytelling shows, and that was to find set pieces that work. So, for instance, I know from telling that story to other people that the Relate story, when I was making notes for this show, I've told that story to a few people, you know, drunk at a party, whatever, and I know that when you get that plant, your plant is dead, it's a real story, and it gets a laugh, and almost everyone goes, oh my God, that's amazing, sure. Right? So I know that set piece is going to get a laugh, and that went in as that's a set piece in that part of the story, and we pretty much look at it like an image. So you have set pieces are like telephone poles, and we start with five of them, a strong opening and a strong ending, because that's what you need for a show. So you need to know where the song. You find one in the middle that's really strong, as strong as you can get, and then you put a couple in between, and then you string the story together so you know you're going to end up with those set pieces. And all the material and information that needs to set those pieces up are like a telephone wire, and it hangs really loose and baggy when you're starting to tell the story, and you might not even get to all five of them. But then what you do is you remember them as you say it, and you slowly clip out the bits and fabric of the and part of the telephone line of things that are unimportant, or people that are unimportant to the story, all extraneous things, till you have a really taut piece of telephone wire stretched across what may end up being about 9 set pieces.
Gotcha.
Does that
okay.
make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That's fascinating. Thank you. That's great.
So if you were to take all you could put, I've got like 3 storytelling shows as well as this. Actually, 4 storytelling shows as well as this one. The Naked Racist and Nearly Gay, The Hero Worship. You could actually put them on top of each other if you were to spread them out, and you'd see the formula. You'd see the format in how I work to get the arc of the story, so
gotcha.
That it's the most satisfying for the audience.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. That's a great analogy. I'd never sort of, I mean, it seems like what a great way to make a show.
Yeah.
When I think of all the flailing around I've done, when I've kind of gone, okay, that bit definitely works and that bit works. Do you change the order of the pieces, if your set pieces, the different telegraph poles? Do you go, okay, that bit maybe, you know, yeah. In order for the story, I tell you why I'm asking. When I sit and write shows, I frequently find myself going, okay, in order to get to there, I've got to know what I'm talking about there, and I don't know how to get there, and I spend a lot of time flailing and worrying.
Yeah. Well, that's what the idea of is. If you make it kind of, this is only how we work is. We drew it on a piece of paper and went. That's actually it was just lines, going. Well, that's well this story that you know there's a. Like in the Naked Racist, it's a linear story. It's because it's 5 hours of an event squeezed into an hour, so I have to follow it linear. So that one, but it's in each part of the story there was a set piece of action that definitely is a something that's interesting. You know that's going to make the audience continue. It gives them hope that they know you're going somewhere.
Yeah,
it allows them to relax because they know even if every bit of information in the story that you heard me tell, not so far because I'm still taking pieces out.
Sure.
But by the end of this run, hopefully every bit of information that's in that story and every sentence in that story will have some bit of information and be important to the overall story. And the audience can sense that whether or not they know it or not. They can sense when someone's just gabbling like I am now and not really clear what they're doing, but they know when someone's being really precise, and those set pieces allow you to go, that's really precise, therefore you trust me that I am going to take you somewhere really satisfying. And then the more satisfying you can make the final peg when it all comes together and you pull all the threads, you've got all these threads of the story, when you pull one of them and it all comes together to form a piece of cloth, the audience guarantee goes, that's well done, and they applaud you for it, because you've been you've done something that any good novelist or any good storyteller does is make it all make sense.
When you've finished a show, and I should say as well, there'll be some opportunity for questions if anyone would like to think of questions. I keep forgetting to say that first, and then so think of some now. We'll come back to you in 5 minutes. When you've made the show, and it works, and it's complete, and it's whole, and it's finished, what are the effects on you and your life now that you've got all that stuff out? Do you know what I mean? Does it have a positive effect? I've heard lots of different answers to this question. Does it have a healing effect to have spoken about the stuff that's been on your mind?
It must do. I mean, I don't want it. I'm really sensitive about it being sort of self-indulgent claptrap, you know, like, because it's so easy to lose, you know, I mean, it's so easy to be doing it for me. And what I'm trying to do is, I hate watching a show where the person on stage, whether it's a theater piece or a comedy piece or whatever it is, where the person's preaching at you and telling you what they think you should think. That includes music and everything. I'd rather watch an artist tell you, express an epiphany that they had about themselves, and then it has some resonance in something, it might mean something to you, and then you hang on to it. That's why you like the favorite songs that you like, and that's why you like your favorite comedians that you like, because they kind of speak to you without being like, this is what you should do. And so when I write these shows, I'm very careful not to get into a situation where I'm being editorializing it. I try to be as honest about them, be brutally honest about them. So in doing that, I guess I kind of discover things about the way I felt about them. In the story this year, The Weary Land, I'm talking about something that happened 15 years ago. I really don't have the emotional, I didn't think I had the emotional baggage attached to it, but you can't help but relive the moments from inside them. And feel something for them. So if anything good has come out, I said to someone today, if anything is good has come out of this show, The Weary Land, whether it does well or gets an audience or gets good reviews or any of that, that would all be very nice. But the best thing of it is I've actually been in contact with my ex-wife about it, because I had to tell her, I'm doing a show and you're in it. I hope you don't mind. In fact, I left it really late. I should have told her like months ago, where she would have had the opportunity to say, I don't want you talking about me. But she it's too late. I wrote, and she was so nice about it. She wrote back to me going, I see all that stuff that happened to us as she's in a really good place, remarried with children. I'm in a really good place. It's all we're just young, stupid, passionate people. Tell them everything. So that's kind of why I would have married her in the first place, because she's quite an honest person. So that's good. That's come out of it. You know, we're now in contact. We're now keeping in touch, and she wants to know how the show goes, because obviously she's in it. And you know, she'll also read the reviews and realize I'm being really nasty about her.
Really horrible. We've got about 10 minutes or so left. If there's any questions, feel free. You can ask about anything if you ask them to me first, and then I'll repeat them for the sake of the recording.
Well,
what do you think of it?
What do I think of? What do I think of it? The development of a sitcom is a long and difficult route, and it takes the amount of work that goes into seeing the shit that you see would blow your mind. If you thought, well, if they put that same amount of development in, if they were, I can think of, you know, 100 writers who could write a brilliant sitcom for you and probably have done, which you will never see. And whether it's a personality or whether it's a vehicle for someone, however they end up with their sitcom, it's still as difficult a process for them. So it's basically, I would say, that someone who ends up in a sitcom where it's just them, has a vehicle for them cracking the jokes they already do on stage, which you've seen and you know, is just because they're not willing to take any risks with the person, and it's probably not the performer's fault themselves. It's probably all the people around them making decisions, going, this is what you should do, this is what you should do, this is what we should do. And most younger performers don't really have the power or the wherewithal to say, that's not what I'm going to do. And I don't think you can be choosy. I don't think there's not like we all sit and go, well, I'm going to choose to do this particular sitcom. You kind of do what you're given. And a lot of there's some great stuff on television. I don't own a TV, but there's some great stuff, and there's some rubbish, and it's always going to be that way.
Well, I'll pass my apologies on to Lee Mack on the
reserve. I think I really like that show, because I think it is actually true to the type of comedian that he is.
And sure.
So if you're, you know, but I don't know. I'm a fan of Lee Mack, so. I think it just depends on.
I think it's certainly true to say if you're not a fan of Lee Mack's stand up, you probably won't like his sitcom.
Because stand up, I'm thinking that man could do that stand up and could do that sitcom in his sleep, quite frankly.
Sure.
Yeah.
It's like, but if they're saying,
well,
you better do this, here's wads of money, it's like, well.
I'm fairly sure he will not do it in his sleep.
No.
I think there's an awful lot of work has gone into that. And I think actually what they've done is, I think what they've done with Lee Mack's sitcom is that they've taken a really bold, interesting direction, which is to have a gag-driven sitcom as opposed to a situation-driven sitcom.
So just making it look like it's easy, he's doing it.
Well, there is a lot of... you're very possibly right there. As someone like Lee Mack... But one thing about Lee Mack is he makes it look extraordinarily easy.
That's
what he does.
Definitely
he
true.
He makes it look as if he does that in his sleep, and there's a lot more stuff going on, and he has to do a lot of work to get to that, I would think. Not to be defensive for him, but...
sure. I think that's one of them.
He's not funny at all at home. You know, that's really hard work for him.
I think that is one of the frustrating things about comedy is that if you're doing it well, you're making it look like you're not working very hard.
Yeah, sure. I mean, who's one of my favorites to watch is Bill Bailey. It doesn't even look like it's written. It looks like he's just coming up with that stuff as on the fly. But we all know he spends hours and hours and hours at home working on the thing that stands out about him, of course, because he does a bit of music. Because this, I think, is true. When you play music, most of the people in here probably don't play music to a concert level. Therefore, when you see someone doing it, even if you don't like particularly the music, you go, well, that's still amazing to watch someone perform like that. But you watch someone perform comedy on a concert level, even though none of you can actually do it. You don't think much of it. You think, well, I'm funny. I was funny last night at a party. And so it's really hard for comedians who are actually working on a really high level not to be able to go, well, that's shit. And my buddy Johnny stuck a banana up his ass in the Barbados, and it was way funnier than that.
You can't have that idea, by the way.
That's my sitcom.
Yeah.
The banana shitters, they're called.
Your legal team is a plantain.
A plantain, yeah. Oh, Jesus.
Okay. Any other questions? Do you get stage fright?
Yes, very, very much so. It depends how comfortable I am with the play. If I'm playing the Comedy Store in London, I don't really, because I've played there enough. I feel like it's my stage and the audience has come to me. But I'm so audience aware that I'm almost too oversensitive about it. I'm really worried about what people are going to think of me. That I get really dry and I can't speak. And I found myself on the bigger programs, on TV galas and things like that. I very much am the type of comedian who will dry. As the last time I did, and when I did the Edinburgh thing here, right before I went on, you can't drink enough water. I was completely dry and I was terrified. And it only becomes a self-feeding thing the more terrified I became. So I went on with being unable to speak. Which you know, when you watch it, you can't quite tell. But if you watch it now, you might be able to tell. I'm not comfortable at all.
Is there any solution for that? Could you do some sort of work to try and get over that?
I don't think you can. I don't know where it comes from. It's about comfort level.
Okay, and it's an anxiety about the approval, maybe.
Yeah. I don't know where it's from. It's just, it's about breathing. You know, it's just about breathing. It's about knowing what suits you. And I, and also going through, you know, people have little things that they do. Every comedian probably a different one, that they, little things they do to make themselves feel comfortable. Some comedians will not come out of their dressing room till right before they're supposed to go on. Some people will hang around backstage for an hour beforehand. Some people will have to go show up at the venue and be on stage and have the mic and have a look around. Other people want to get out of a car and come straight in through the theater. So it depends. I'm often better when I haven't had a chance to think about it. When I come from another show and I'm sweating and thinking about the show and I'm just pushed on stage, I don't have time to think about it. But if it's when you're doing TV and stuff like that, there's a lot of sitting around and I get really wound up about it.
Yeah. Is that? Do you think there's a chance that anxiety or that need to be approved of is the origin of your hyperactivity on stage? That you've got this hugely manic energy a lot of the time. Not so much in your Edinburgh shows, which are more sort of reflective, but your club sets.
It's fear driven, absolutely. Yeah. Totally fear driven. Yeah. When I started doing, this sounds really dull now, but when I started,
this is exactly what we want to hear.
When I started doing after the Juice Pigs, and I started to go back to doing open spot stuff, I was terrified that I wasn't as going to be as good. Like, I was going to get caught out for getting away with it for 10 years. And
for 10 years, you could do 10 years and you could think, you could still worry that you'd been just getting away with it.
Yeah, getting away with it, absolutely. And so I would come on, run, and I didn't have a lot of material, so I came running on stage just being quite manic and hyper and climbing over the audience and doing stuff that is actually, to be honest, was influenced by Phil Kaye, because that's the way he used to perform. He used to make something happen in the room, just to make something happen in the room. You never knew what to expect. And I loved that, watching that. So I tried to be a purveyor of that style of comedy, but it was out of sheer nervousness of not having anything to do. So when I saw someone stand there really deadpan and not blink and tell jokes and have an audience laughing, I thought they were absolute genius.
Yeah. Excellent, amazing answer. Any others? Any other questions? Yes, over here. Can I just repeat for the sake of the recording? Yeah. So what we're talking about is digressions. When comedians digress from their subject in between, as you say, the Telegraph polls, how often, I guess, are you asking Phil, how often for him or how often for comics in general? How often is that staged,
yeah,
effectively?
How
scripted digression.
Staged and scripted attack. Because, yeah, obviously, like, when they get back on point, it makes you think, well, that was really clever, how they just sort of went off.
Sure.
You're impressed with the craft, but, like...
Sure. So we're talking here about the illusory, you know, the illusion of, oh, I'm doing it for the first time, I've accidentally ended up back here.
Well, I would say that it's completely crafted. But I don't know them personally, but I would say completely crafted, but at the same time, they have an audience, the audience that are going to pay to see Billy Connolly or Eddie Izzard or Ross Noble or any of the people that do that kind of thing are already going to be going for that reason. And therefore, they feel free, if it's going well, to push it a little bit further. So a routine, and I could, any one of them could correct me, but I would say that a lot of it is written in front of the audience and extended each time they add an extension or they go, get an audience going, or something happens in an audience that allows them to propel it a bit further, and they just remember it, and they keep it, and then they go that far the next time before going back on topic. And I remember driving with Ross Noble when he was about a 16-year-old comic, and he was driving me down to somewhere like, it wasn't Falmouth, but somewhere quite far away, and he had a long time to talk about comedy, and he already at that point had decided that he was going to build towers of material and have them have different towers of material and be able to swing between them fluidly, and he already had a clear image in his mind, which is similar to my image, except my image is about storytelling shows, and so it's quite linear. But his was free to allow himself to look freeform while at the same time knowing exactly what platform he was about to go to and choosing them, and be able to move so quickly between them that the audience appears to the audience like it's a freeform show. And I think if you go and see someone like that 3 or 4 nights in a row, most of the time it's going to be a very similar set, maybe not in the same order. But certainly, the more you do it, it's easier to do that. Someone like Phil Kaye, for instance, I don't think the show he's doing this year is more about his stories. So I've heard them a few times, and he's sort of buffed them up. But when he's in a free form, when he can stand there for like 20 minutes with a guitar in front of an audience and die for the first 18 minutes, and then suddenly for the last 2 minutes do something absolutely wonderfully glorious, because the audience knows for the first 18 minutes he was just making it up, that then the last 2 minutes it has to be the same, and because it's glorious, he gets double the applause or the I think that's does that answer your question?
Yeah.
It's really rare. It's really, really rare amongst all these guys. You know, all of the people. All of us want to make it look like we're improvising or saying it off the hoof, because that's the key to good comedy. Is the audience doesn't know where it's going. Some of them, the purveyors of that kind of I'm going off over here and then I come back. I would say it's very much crafted.
But there are a few, aren't there? There are a few. There's a Phil Kay.
Yeah.
I mean, I know Tony Law. He has written stuff and crap, and I'm interviewing him tomorrow if anyone would like to return here.
Yeah,
so we'll put that question to him. But I'm sure that I've seen him several times, like in a row, and I've gone, oh, that's new, and that's a new take on that, and that's something else. But there's that bit I recognise.
I saw Tony 2 days ago, and he'd finished his show, and he was having a writing session with Storm, who he writes with. Who sees all of his shows, and he'll do the same thing. He's got routines and ideas and concepts that he works, and he keeps working in them. And he's working towards an Edinburgh show, so he will work on that from the end of this Edinburgh show. When he loses all this material, he'll start working on all the next material. So everything that you see him doing, it'll constantly grow and evolve, but it's still crafted. I mean, it's a lot of work goes into that. A lot of work.
I think it'd be fascinating as well if anyone had the sort of budget or resources to do it, but to go and see someone in one of their very first previews of a show, and then go and spend a fortune to see that show in an arena near the end of the tour, and see how much you recognise and how many sort of you recognise elements of it with a lot more work done on them.
Yeah.
We have got sort of not really any time left. If there's any burning questions, we could do one more, or otherwise we'll wrap up
just
there.
Just yes or no questions at this point.
Phil, thank you so much. You've been really, I really appreciate how honest you are, and you're fiddling with your shirt. I can tell you're nervous.
No, this is something I've done since I was very young. Adam Bloom pointed out to me, is I have this thing, I roll fabric. It seems weird, doesn't it? I roll fabric. And I remember when I was young, I used to be really nervous, of a nervous disposition. I used to take my T-shirt and start it rolling. And then once I got it rolling, I could roll the whole thing up. And my mother used to hit me because it was stretching, ruining all my T-shirts. And it's something I've always done, but I think as I've got older, I've become make it more subtle, so you don't really notice it unless you've known me. And Adam Bloom went, "You roll your shirt," and I was like, "Oh my god, I'm not doing it very well." I tend to stand with my hand behind my back, and I do that
secretly, shirt rolling.
Yeah. So it's not when I'm nervous; I just do it all the time. It makes me feel good. But same time, if you want a spliff, I'm your man.
Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking Mr. Phil Nichol.
So that was Phil. Thank you so much to the fabulous Phil Nichol. My favourites are always when people really expose themselves, and I think you have to be very brave to do that. So do follow him at Phil Nichol and check out his own website for a typically candid explanation of his feelings towards all of his previous shows. I mentioned that in the interview, and that's really worth a look, is to watch someone over 15 years go through a process of just being able to look back and reflect on where each show came from and how he feels about it now. It's fascinating stuff. Thanks, as ever, to Dan Melrose, James Lowy, Pete Jones, and all of that gang. The live show in Edinburgh was produced with assistance from Anthony Butler at So Television. Thank you for listening. Do get in touch. I've been Stuart Goldsmith, and I will speak to you next time.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
Well, something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional unprofessional, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.